Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Changes to the federal food assistance programs are in the works, with one deadline coming up today. From Marketplace in Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams in for David Brancaccio. Today is the last day for interested parties to comment on proposed changes to the federal food stamp program, SNAP. The Trump administration wants to cut $130 billion over a decade. At the center of this story is hunger, but the retailers who sell the food may also have to adapt. Marketplace's Erica Barris has one angle.
Faced with SNAP cuts, brick-and-mortar stores that sell groceries could stand to lose billions in revenue. Most SNAP dollars are used at big-box discount stores, and 10% of grocery spending in the U.S. happens through SNAP benefits. The cuts would be devastating to the people who use SNAP to buy their food, says Elizabeth Wolkemeer with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. And she says retailers of all sizes are worried.
It would also hurt businesses across the country that rely on SNAP purchases as a source of revenue.
Especially smaller food stores in communities where many customers use SNAP. Ted Stenger with Alex Partner says the revenue loss may force stores to cut hours and let go of employees.
And ultimately, it could lead in some instances to the closure of stores.
Exactly how the 2019 federal budget will impact the food stamp program isn't entirely clear yet. But cuts are coming, and retailers are bracing for the ripple effect. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
We're also watching gasoline markets this morning. Typically, retail gas prices go up during the summer driving season, starting on Memorial Day. But this year, analysts have been noticing a trend towards higher prices, which seems to be showing up at the gas pumps already. Marketplace's Marielle Segura is here, and what's going on?
So I know it may not seem like it, especially here in New York, where it's currently 36 degrees, but summer is coming. And every year as summer gets closer, gas prices tend to go up. The main reason is that the gas you buy during the summer is actually different than the gas you buy during the winter. It's less likely to evaporate in the heat, and that's required by federal environmental regulations. They're meant to prevent pollution. The summer gas is also more expensive for oil refineries to make. And so in the spring, as they start making the switch, the price you pay for gas at the pump goes up too. And we're starting to see that already. AAA says gas prices have jumped 13 cents in the past month.
Marielle, thank you.
Objective, trustworthy journalism matters. We hear from listeners like you every day that Marketplace helps you understand the financial forces that affect our lives so that you can make better decisions. Now, this is your chance to be part of our efforts to raise economic intelligence across the country. When you support Marketplace today, your donation will be matched dollar for dollar by our friends at the Candida Fund. As a nonprofit news organization, we're counting on your help so that we can continue to grow and keep getting better. Don't miss out on this chance to make your donation go twice as far. Become a Marketplace investor today in whatever amount is right for you. You do it by going to marketplace.org.
During the Great Financial Crisis, Sheila Bair was head of the FDIC. That's the government office that insures the bank deposits of typical Americans. She saw the mortgage crisis with greater clarity and earlier than just about everyone. David Brancaccio recently spoke with her on the air about the lessons from all of that. It's part of our Divided Decade coverage we're doing on the deeper meanings of the crisis 10 years on. David also asked her what she's worried about now in 2018. Listen to what she said.
Student debt, yes. I am very well. I just don't like unaffordable debt, period, you know, and there is so much. It's a huge fiscal problem, too. We got about $1.3 trillion of federal student debt now. Very, very high default rates. A recent report just came out for those who graduated in 2004. Default rates will approach 40%. So I have been a big advocate of something called income share. It's an approach they use in some European countries as well as Australia.
Yeah, so this notion of income sharing, how does it work?
So it's basically a contract. If the government did it, a student would enter into a contract with the government, that the government would provide funding up to a certain common sense level for their college education. But the idea is you pay back a percentage of your income, so it's always affordable. You know, after a certain period of years, your obligation ends. And it has nice features from an economic standpoint as well, because, again, when you get into a downturn, people lose jobs, have their hours cut back, what have you.
But they wouldn't have to pay back as much.
Their payment automatically adjusts. Unlike debt that's fixed, you default on the loan, the bank or the government in this case has to take a loss. That cuts back on other consumer lending. You don't have that with income share. The payment automatically adjusts with whatever your income level is.
But where are we with this public policy proposal? It's not just you, but it's not front and center in Washington either, is it?
No, it's not. It's frustrating. So there are colleges. Purdue, for instance, has launched an ISA. A couple of other liberal arts colleges, some coding schools have launched ISAs. These are being funded from private sources. And so private sources are going to be looking for returns. So I think it would be very helpful if philanthropy and government, particularly government, would step up and at least fund some pilots. My guess is that it's going to be better for everybody. It's going to be better for the student. It's going to be better for taxpayers. It's going to take the stress of debt off of the shoulders of the student. It's really, the risk is almost exclusively on students now in terms of being able to pay back that debt. There's no skin in the game for the college other than some accountability rules that are quite complex and primarily apply to for-profit. So getting, you know, focused on the students and having colleges share in the risk if the students do not succeed in the workforce, I think that's an important feature of this.
Sheila Bair ran the FDIC during the financial crisis. That's the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Now she's the chair of the Non-Governmental Systemic Risk Council. There's more of David's interview on marketplace.org, including Bair's take on whether the government meddled too much during the financial crisis. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.